Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
Program complete. Enter when ready.
The curtain of night is drawn back. The telescopes are trained. The domes are open. The audience is set. Now, step into the event horizon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the event horizon here on Astronomy.fm Radio. It is another Friday evening, and this one happens to be November the 3rd, 2017, 9 o'clock in the evening. For those of us,
and we're going to do what we do every Friday night, Marcy. We're going to take over the world.
That's right.
Thank you, Starstorm. Now, you have to excuse me, folks. I'm a little bit blary. I've got a head cold, so at some point I may decide, yeah, had enough. I don't think you're going to want to listen to me go like this all the time, so we'll see what happens. Oh, by the way, Marty.
Yes.
50th anniversary for Doctor Who was November the 23rd, 2013. So we're probably about 55, 56 years, maybe 57.
Something like that. Coming up, yes. No, well, it's November already, so.
Yeah, so it's the anniversary month, and we'll be also 20 more days to its next anniversary.
Mm-hmm. We were just talking, and other people in our chat room. By the way, come on over to our chat room at astronomy.fm. Look for where it says radio chat. Click on that. Type in a name. Hit login, and you'll be here. Glad to have you here. You can ask us questions. We're watching our chat live right now. So if you have questions on astronomy, type them into the chat room, and we'll try to answer them for you on our program. More than happy to do that. So, especially since we're going to repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. So if you got a question, you know, try to type it in now, and then we'll answer it. And you can even hear it on the repeat if you want to do it that way. Let's say hi to everybody in our chat room so far. We've got you and me. We've got Aqua for You, Glenn, Starstorm, Black Projects, Twist Edge, and Optronics, an international audience tonight from the UK, Canada, and Buenos Aires. And us here.
I was just thinking, Marty, you know what we were discussing before we actually went live? Let's think about it. Lost in Space. So Star Trek came in 66, 3 years after Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
You also had the Outer Limits, mm-hmm, and the Twilight Zone, mm-hmm, which were running actually just before Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. But Doctor Who was the really big competition that American sci-fi or science fantasy shows actually faced.
Mm-hmm.
That and the fact that the writers paid a little bit more attention to science. Mm-hmm. Certainly much more in the episode where the fourth Doctor is at Jodrell Bank. At least he doesn't go and do what Jodie Foster does, which is to plug a pair of earphones into one of the aerials and try and listen to the universe. At least they didn't get that right. what else did we have? Oh, we had Quatermass.
Oh, yes.
I don't think Quatermass actually made it very well. I think a lot of Americans didn't like it. It was a little bit too scary with some of its post-war thoughts. And
I've seen it in, obviously, repeats, but never original for that one.
I actually have the first three Quatermass movies. Now, bear in mind, it started off really in the movies first, and then it got onto the TV and went to TV. And I think the last ever real Quatermass story was back in the 1980s with Sir John Mills playing Professor Bernard Quatermass and in a post-apocalyptic world where a bunch of aliens have reacted a harvesting station. Interestingly, bang smack in Wembley Stadium, I think one of them was.
Ooh.
Anyway, people vanished into green misty goo.
Yeah.
But it was certainly interesting. There was a lot of competition, I think. Yeah, you had Lost in Space, which went from black and white to colour. Interestingly, Star Trek was actually filmed in colour because NBC, if I remember right, made a really big thing about it. It was their way of selling colour television.
Mm-hmm.
because the whole thing was Star Trek was made and broadcast in color. So if you had a color TV at that time, you got to see it in color. Mm-hmm. A lot of people obviously had to make do with black and white. Yep. And of course, I think in the late 60s, BBC started playing with color transmissions. I think BBC Two went first, the very first shows in color, and then BBC One and ITV, when it finally came around, started really dishing into color. Of course, we had Invaders, all kinds of weird and wonderful shows, and I think from when Doctor Who really started going, I think from about the third episode of the first Doctor, the sci-fi war, so to speak, that really started, transatlantic sci-fi war, because Doctor Who was really taking people by storm. I think the thing people loved about it was in the early stories, there were historical settings, and the BBC did its usual thing, and they went all out insane to recreate historical costumes, scenes, and events.
Something like about the OK Corral? Sometime.
Yes, the Doctor Who, even the first Doctor, even went to take part in the gunfight at the OK Corral, in the gunfighters, which is sadly basically a missing episode. And of course, still the word is going out to people who had the early video recorders. If you recorded it, Doctor Who, in the early days, and you have particularly the first, second, and some of the third Doctor stories, please, please let us know. We will buy from you. And BBC Worldwide Television literally did.
How many have they recovered at this point?
As Darston is saying, how many have they recovered? Quite a fair bit. They've got pretty much most of the third Doctor's seasons.
And didn't they recently find an old...
Yes, they actually found some video from the second. Yep. They actually found an old Cyberman story. So eventually that will get...
And they animated some of it?
They animated some of it to actually complete the story. So really, it was quite interesting. Science fiction became science fact when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin stepped out onto the moon and actually did walk on the moon for the first time and make man's first giant leap. Well, mankind's first giant leap anyway. Everybody
one
says...
One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Thank you, Starstorm. See? See how well I've taught her history?
There you go.
but seriously, if it wasn't for shows like Doctor Who, Invaders, Quatermass, because Quatermass was basically the British rocket group. Britain had its own space program, like it does again. We just toddled off to Woomera in Australia because it was a much better launching location for us than, say, the UK. So we would ship our rockets.
Better weather,
yeah, I'll say that. I've seen some of the pictures from Woomera when they were putting the Black Knight et al. Rockets together for launch. Everybody was in T-shirt, in shorts and short sleeve shirts.
And it wasn't raining. Which it quite often does.
There's a comment from our radio director, less people for the nuke shots. But seriously, it's interesting. Science fiction has become science fact.
We have a question in the chat.
Can you see Doctor Who in a telescope? Well, old chap, I don't quite know. It really depends where the TARDIS is. And don't forget, the TARDIS is very, very good at hiding herself.
Sometimes too good.
So,
as proven by the one episode during the Sixth Doctor's run, when it turned into it was a harpsichord or a piano, I think.
It was a pipe organ. That was for one of Colin Baker's stories when he met up with the Cybermen. So, as I say, why are we talking science fiction? Because science fiction becomes science fact. And also, Collier's magazine here in the US frequently had some of the greatest covers going ever. They had the ideas of what our rocket ships going to the moon would look like when they were landing. And, of course, they had articles by Wernher von Braun in them, highly technical articles, in which a lot of people reveled in, because here is the premier American rocket man now talking about what he is doing to put man on the moon. obviously von Braun had other ideas. He wanted to go to Mars too. He wrote books explaining how he felt NASA could do all this, given an Apollo-sized budget. Sadly, of course, Apollo got axed. The last three missions never flew. They became Skylab's 1-2 and the Apollo-Soyuz link-up. Having said that, the legacy, of course, is now the fact that we had Skylab, we had an orbital habitat, prematurely shortened because we messed up on the math, but never mind.
But we can go back and fix it.
But we can go back and fix it, we can redo the math, we can put the space station somewhere better, better orbit, better locations, and this time... I can tell you, I definitely have one of the Mars generation sitting next to me. Repair the rovers on Mars. Yeah, you know what? This what you heard it, folks. Starstorm wants the rovers on Mars upgraded. Apart from the fact they're actually sending one to Mars with 23 cameras on board. But
that's Mars 2020.
Yep. I think that, as I recollect, is actually one of the potential collaborations between JAXA and France. Now, I did actually have an article on this on my Facebook page, so just bear with me. No, I haven't lost the article. It's not that far away. It was only a few days ago. I was actually talking to one of my friends in Japan. Hey, here we go. Mars. Yeah, it is Mars 2020. Let me see if I can... No. So, basically, it's got a super cam, it's got a remote micro imager, Mars Cam Z times two nav cams. It has a micro context camera. It has front hazard cams. It has rear hazard cams.
That's for insurance purposes.
Quite probably, in case it hits something.
or gets hit by a Russian rover.
Or he gets stood on by a Decepticon. Sorry, I had to go there, yes. But, okay. Let me see if I can copy the image address and put it into chat. You know what? We are going places.
I put one link in there.
Okay. Nice.
You're right.
That comes up nicely. It's a big old link, but it works. In fact, one of the extended cameras is called Sherlock Watson. So you know what? Yeah, I can think if Holmes' spirit was with us, he'd probably be chuckling, sucking on his pipe, and laughing and saying, "Interesting, indubitably interesting."
All right, and tell Starstorm it has a video player screen in the back of one of the front seats, so she can watch videos while she's riding in the back seat.
Starstorm, I'm told to tell you that the Mars 2020 mission has a video player, so you can sit in the back seat and watch things as you trundle around Mars. You know what? 23 cameras, 9 engineering cameras, 7 science cameras, 9 entry, descent, and landing cameras. That is an impressive haul for cameras.
Mm-hmm.
And I do see there's a little area at the back. I think they're supposed to be for scientific experiments. But as I say, it is fascinating. It's nice that we're actually beginning to build these things. I'm sure that my old friend who built Beagle, would probably, if he's hovering around somewhere, given the time of year, would probably be very pleased to see something that could actually be considered a direct descendant of his late lamented probe actually doing well and going to Mars. Maybe this will beat the hoodoo.
Mm-hmm.
But Optronics is saying something. Your neighbor is Viet Cong Aqua. Oh, I see. Yeah, Aqua for you said, my neighbor up the street has met Elan and Bezos. I asked him to take me along next time. He's a high up VC at Silicon Valley Connex. Oh dear, I think there's a little bit of fun being poked at people by other people in the chat room, but I do have to laugh at that one. And Aqua for you is saying venture capitalist. I can see that, but you know, we're gonna go at Mars, and I think it is gonna be people like Bezos, Musk, going along with the big space agencies. That everybody's beginning to work together finally on projects. So maybe we're going to, once we have the Extreme Falcons and Wild Blue and Blue Yonder up and running, we have the potential and the ability to finally go there, to put that same blueprint onto Martian soil. You know what? Maybe they should take one of Neil's boots with them. Borrow it, take it, use that very first footprint on Mars is from Neil's boot. I bet he'd get a charge out of that, Marty.
I know. Maybe they could make, like, you know, 1 foot go around the probe on one side and the other foot go around the probe on the other side.
Hey, that's an even better idea. Take one of Buzz's with them, too.
There you go.
But
How about a Bigfoot, you know, imprint?
No.
Put a Bigfoot imprint on the bottom of a boat and walk around that way.
Well, you know what would happen then? You would have the conspiracy nuts going ballistic and
start to
lobby the government that Mars should be off limits to humans. We need Mars. We're going to have space probes actually going specifying missions to Phobos and Deimos. I tend to think in reality, I think it's Phobos. Phobos is more of a rotten potato. And I'm beginning to think maybe it's actually maybe just a pile of rubble that's caressed together and kept in place. And I think once it gets out of Mars's gravity or gets too deep into the gravity well, that will be a spectacular light show for anybody who just happens to be on the surface of Mars at that point.
Oh, I could go to Mars.
I have a Mars a day. That makes my day. For those of you who don't know what I mean, a Mars bar is an English confection. It's chocolate, caramel, glucose, and a little bit of toffee on top, and delicious chocolate. Let's say the Mars a day helps you work, rest, and play. Certainly going to Mars would.
Obviously, they're here in the UK too. I mean, the U.S. also.
Well, what you call a Mars bar is completely different. Deep-fried Mars bars. Only in Glasgow, my friend. Only in Glasgow. See you, Jimmy. Hang on. Starstorm wants a word. Come on, then.
I suggest taking a supply of Snickers with you to Mars.
There you go. That'll keep the divas under control. A Snickers a day.
So have you had a deep-fried Mars bar?
Yes, I have had a deep fried Mars bar.
Really? Now, is it like, wrapped in like breading first before it goes in the fryer, or is it just straight in?
They put it in the same batter as they do the fish. The fish batter. Then they dunk it into the fat fryer like it's a piece of fish.
Okay. And how's it taste?
Different.
So we'll call it an acquired taste then.
Yes, I would definitely say it's kind of the same type of acquired taste as maybe haggis or black pudding.
Okay, like a space probe flying by a planet, I will pass.
Having said that, that's probably why the incident of heart attacks in Glasgow is probably so high, because all the deep fried Mars bars they eat.
Got a couple launches coming up this week. On Friday the 10th, we're going to launch a JPSS 1 weather satellite. I can go to the NASA website for that one if you want to see that. It'll be at 4 o'clock in the morning Eastern time, and Eastern U.S. time. And also then Saturday right after that, Saturday, November 11th, will be launch of the ATK cargo resupply mission to the space station. That'll be about 7:30 Saturday morning. And must be after the daylight savings time. This Saturday, by the way, will be off of our daylight savings time and back onto standard time. Sorry, not Saturday, but it's actually Sunday morning.
2 a.m. Sunday morning.
2 a.m. Sunday morning. So, yeah. So if you stay up late Saturday night to 2 a.m., we're going to fall back to 1 o'clock. So get ready next week, everybody listening in, that the times for shows can be off by an hour if you're not correcting for daylight savings time change. So keep that in mind. So you might want to make sure you do the calculations or get here a little extra early, an hour early, in case you miss the live portion of the program next week. So that would be all of them. That would be the live presentations of York University, Space Pirates, and the Event Horizon.
Now, comets.
Comets, yes.
Comets, yes, comets. Now, I've heard a lot of people talking about C-2017 T1 Heinz, binocular comet for the new year. I am not going to say it's going to be a binocular comet for the new year.
I don't think so.
Why? I don't. I don't think so. It's just been this recently discovered, November 1st. It's supposed to zoom by the Earth in January and May. Now, Bob King, I totally agree with on this. May just show up in your binoculars. Now, he's found it using the University of Hawaii's Atlas system. Now, to put this in context, Heinz searches for near-Earth asteroids with the asteroid terrestrial impact last alert system, Atlas. And he came across the comet taken in images on October 2nd. So the survey uses two telescopes, one on Mauna Loa on Hawaii itself, and the second on the summit of Hekulaka on Maui. But okay, I get problems with some of these names, I admit it. Now, that's about 100 miles to the northwest. Now, the great benefit is the two widely spaced eyes allow for distance determination using parallax, which also helps in calculating the orbit. So Brian Marsden will probably be jumping up and down with joy because he's got two telescopes, both within 100 miles of each other, and they can give a very good determination for distance using parallax. As Marsden used to say, if it emits light or makes an explosion, I want to know about it. So is this going to be a brilliant comet? Well, at the moment, I don't think so, because it is way, way down there. It's 18th magnitude in October, 18th magnitude in Hydra with a 7-degree wide coma and a 10-degree long tail pointing southwest. Now, the preliminary orbit seems to indicate that the object was an Atan type, near-Earth asteroid spouting dust. We know this happens. Because an awful lot of dormant asteroids, they may venture a little bit away from their regular orbits, perturbed perhaps by Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars. And they then perhaps come close into the system and they start acting like comets. Some of them, we believe, could actually be dead comets. And I refer you to a conversation that I had a while ago with Messrs. Hill, Scotty, and Kowalski on Comet Watch. Now, perihelion doesn't occur until February the 21st at a distance of 87 million kilometers. But prior to that, on January the 4th, it's supposed to pass within 33 million kilometers from the Earth. Now, given its intrinsic faintness, it's predicted to peak at magnitude 8.8. This is according to JPL Horizons and Yusichi Yoshida. So that puts it within the range of most small telescopes and 50 millimeter or larger binoculars. So 20 by 80s, maybe. Will it be a spectacular tail? I don't know. Because basically, comets are like cats. They have tails and they do with them what they like. And I've seen too many predictions for a fantastic light show just fizzle. I'm sure most of us remember Comet Ison as being one. Comets Kohoutek and West in the past were others. Now, if we're lucky, maybe we'll get to see something. And again, you're probably going to need to use averted vision. And Marty, I will let you explain that to our audience.
Yeah, averted vision is, well, at nighttime, the most sensitive part of your eye is actually not directly in the back of your eye, but it's slightly off to the side. So if at nighttime when the light's really dim, if you look directly at an object, it won't appear as bright as if you kind of look off to the side, then glance back over towards the object. It'll actually brighten it up just a little bit better and maybe detectable, where looking straight at it won't be detectable. So yes, try using averted vision. It's going to depend a lot on your sky conditions, too. It's really sometimes a matter of contrast. So the darker the sky background you have, the better chance you have of seeing a very faint object that's slightly brighter than the background. Now, if your background is actually brighter than the object, you're not going to be able to see it at all. So that's where, especially when you get on the edge of visibility from some objects like this. So eighth magnitude comet, a little bit deceiving. It's not going to look like an eighth magnitude star. It'll look like an eighth magnitude star out of focus, which will make it expand, will actually make it appear dimmer. So it might be equivalent of more like 11th, 12th magnitude object. Yeah, it's a little deceiving when they say eighth magnitude. I've had a hard time actually seeing eighth magnitude comets. If they're too diverse, spread out, it actually technically appears much fainter and really might be about the level of light polluted background skies.
Now, the interesting thing is, given the comet's proximity to our planet and the steep orbital inclination of 97 degrees, it's going to be a well-placed, fast-moving object for Northern Hemisphere sky watchers prior to perihelion. Now, post-perihelion, I want to be down with Terry Lovejoy and the Swan Hill gang, because it's going to make a mad dash south when it becomes accessible to Southern Hemisphere viewers. So this is the time, folks, to probably sign up for iTelescope and learn how to use it, because places like the SSO are going to be your best bet. So there's going to be a mad scramble, I suspect, to get onto telescopes owned by iTelescope, particularly in the Southern Hemisphere. And to be honest, they've got some terrific scopes, but they are fairly limited to ones in Australia. Now, that's going to be changing. I've had a survey sent to me asking me to list where I'd like to have observatories. So I was thinking about the school kids and the Liverpool telescope, and I thought, you know what, I'd like to see them in Nepal, I'd like to see them in Thailand, I'd like to see them in the Philippines. I'd like to see iTelescope in Chile, too, because that can be a very good location to observe from remotely. And particularly if you can sight it maybe close to maybe the Atacama scopes and have ESO give it a little bit of parenting every now and again, particularly when the domes either refuse to shut or open. So basically, this comet, as it gets closer, will be traveling about 7 degrees a day, which is about... hang on a second, let me read this right. 7 degrees a day, or 17 arc seconds an hour. I'm not too sure about that. But it's going to be fast enough to see movement in real time. And during the first half of January, it will be circumpolar for mid-northern latitudes and visible all night. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, if you've got access to a scope, or you can get access to, say, maybe Mayhill, Sierra Nevada, or even scopes out at Nerpico and other places, get there, get observing, and get your pictures. We don't know if this is going to be a regular visitor yet. We don't have a solid orbit. So there is an image... Nope, that's not on it. That's nothing to do with it. That's to do with the Moon and Aldebaran. But if you want to catch this one, I really recommend that you get moving and get set up. If you've got your own telescope and you've got CCDs, make plans to image from a nice dark sky location. Practice, practice, practice. Get everything practiced, setting up, imaging, processing. Because when you get your images from this particular comet, it's going to be literally a once in a lifetime. Until the Minor Planet Center can give us a really good orbit, this may actually be in its way in and then on its way out again for a very long time. And who knows, maybe never to be seen again anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right now I've got the map on it. I put it in our chat room. The position, it's just about rising right now. Just south of Cancer the Crab, and it's going to actually travel up through Cancer the Crab right around the third week of December, and then from there it's going to go north of Gemini, through Lynx, Camelopardalis, and then where's it going to go? And it's going to shoot across the sky, come down through Andromeda Pegasus region, or maybe a little farther between actually Pegasus and Cygnus would be a little bit more accurate, I should say. And then it's going to go down by Aquila, the eagle. That would be in February, into Aquarius in March. And then pass by Capricorn in April, to give you an idea. And then keep heading south into Pisces Australis, so kind of close to Fomalhaut, Grux, Toucan, and then Octans, and keep on going that way. That would be right around June or so.
And I can imagine that some of the Swan Hill crowd, I'm sure Terry will be out after it. And I will have words with some people, the likes of Rodney, Austin, and a few others, to see if we can get something coordinated for a combined imaging run. It would be nice to capture this one. It would be nice to put up a few pictures on the AFM Facebook page and or maybe even on the actual show page eventually.
Mm-hmm. The link will be in, of course, on our Facebook page, on our home page, and you can also go to weekly. I type in my search engine, Weekly Bright Comets. Type that in your search engine, and that will get you to where I found this finder chart on. It's not in Chasing Comets, Skyhound, but it is in Weekly Bright Comets. So, and then remember, right now it's faint, 16th plus magnitude, so yeah, just for imagers. Break.
You go to Comet Live. It's on their website as well. So that's a nice little website, because the simple fact is you can move the pointer to your home location or to wherever the telescope is located you're going to work through, and that will show you where when the comet rises, when it sets, and when it's in a good altitude to be imaged. So that's always a good site to check. Primarily because you can actually put Nerpico, Spain in, you can put Sierra Nevada, you can put Mayhill, you can put the SSO in, and it will tell you if it's going to be visible.
There you go. All right. I want, of course, it's time for station identification. You're listening to the Event Horizon here on astronomy.fm radio. We're about halfway through our program right now, a little bit beyond half past the hour of November the 3rd, 2017. Friday night for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America, also known as about 1:30 in the morning, Saturday morning, November the 17th, November the 4th, 2017. Get that date a little bit twisted there. So still have a program to listen to, and don't forget we've got more programming coming up after the Event Horizon, like 365. So check that one out. And, of course, come on over to our chat room at astronomy.fm. Go look where it says radio chat. Click on that. Just type in a name you want us to refer to you by, and you'll be here. Shoot the log. If you want to ask us questions, feel free to do so. We'll answer them right on air. In fact, let's say hi to everybody in our chat room right now. We got you and me, Aquafew, Glenn, Starstorm, Black Projects, Twist Edge, and Optronics. Glad to have everybody in our chat room live right now.
See, the thing is...
Yes. You were saying?
Aquafew was saying about instead of taking his laptop up the hill with him, he prints his star maps out at home. I prefer actually to either take the laptop out into the garden, into the to where the scope is, connect it all up, and then just put a box over it, make a little laptop cave. That'll help keep the stray light down as well, particularly if you've got a red filter running.
Yes, but that helps. But the laptop, I like printed charts also a little bit better, because what I could do is I could take them out in hand, binoculars in hand, red light, shine the red light onto the star chart and hold it up in the air next to where the general constellation is that I'm going to be looking at, and kind of go back and forth between visually looking at the constellation and looking at the star chart. A little bit difficult to hold an entire laptop up with one hand. And if you don't go to...
Just get a little table, mate.
Well, if you don't go... Well, it's kind of hard to hold it up in the air, like above head height, when you want to, use it right next to the constellation you're looking at. So, and then, of course, you got to get it to red mode. You got to be able to brighten and dim it down as you need it. A little bit difficult to do, but it's easy to shine the flashlight onto the chart, move it away, on the chart, move it away with a red flashlight. Makes it a little bit easier that way for me. So I prefer the printed page too.
Yeah, I do have printed charts. I have Urania. I have Will Tyron's excellent star maps, which I keep in the observatory.
Mm-hmm.
I can't get to them right now, but it's a lovely chart. It's very conducive to being used. Ah, there it is, he says. Excuse me a second.
Alrighty. Juno recently made a close pass to the planet Jupiter. That was back on, it was October the 24th, but Jupiter's kind of like behind the sun right now, so they had to wait a little while until now to be able to transmit the data around the sun back to the Earth. So, yeah, definitely made a nice successful pass, and of course some brand new images of what Jupiter's south pole happens to appear like right now. So always good images from the Juno mission flying around Jupiter right now.
Hi, Cassie. Welcome to the show.
Yes, indeed.
Glad you can make it. The thing is, yeah, paper charts are great. But the thing is, I have totally gone to the dark side. I do imaging. I don't do visual observing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I do visual observing of the moon because I like to crater hop sometimes with either the binoculars or with a small telescope. But then I'm going to want to take a photograph. So I tend to set everything up, connect the laptop to the camera so I can see the image live. I'll focus on it using the software for the camera via the laptop. And I will look and I'll guide the scope using Virtual Moon Atlas onto the area of the moon I'm interested in. To be honest, when I go out imaging, I'm looking for maybe two things, maybe three. Really depends. Sometimes if I get interested in Jupiter, I'll go look for Jupiter and Saturn every now and again. But really, I'm looking at the moon and I'm looking at comets. So it's easier for me to image and actually look at the tape direct as it's forming on my screen.
Yes.
And, of course, the other nice thing is, of course, I'm using planetarium software literally to guide the scope. So if I decide I want to go and look for a comet, I'll shut down VMA, and I will then go and run up Starry Nights Pro Plus 6. That's where I'm at the moment, or the Sky X. I like both. And then I will tell that what my target is, and then I will just sit and watch on the screen.
Not to mention that handy-dandy phone app you've got.
Oh, yeah, my handy-dandy phone app, as she points out.
There you go.
that's the fun thing, because you can actually, there are apps that will guide your telescope from your phone.
Yep.
They use Bluetooth connections. I think one version is available on Android. There's about two versions on Android, and there's at least one version on iOS. So you are not really stuck at buying one type of phone. You can buy the phone you want. You can find the app, but you need to make sure that the phone you've got is capable of running it. That, and of course, by going the Android route, I find all my apps are so much cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Little bit of solar activity. No sunspots, but there has been some coronal holes. So wind speeds are up, but just barely for the sun. So, yeah, if you have to be standing on the North Pole of the Earth, you're going to see some nice aurora or slightly south of that, but generally not a whole lot of activity coming off the sun right now.
Well, you know what? It goes through quiet periods. This is a variable star after all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it decides to wake up and give everybody a fright by kicking off M and X flares and really waking everybody up.
There you go. Got an occultation of the moon and Aldebaran coming up Sunday night around 8 o'clock-ish, and then on for a little while after that. And it actually looks good for North America, too. So check that one out if you're out observing Sunday night. Aldebaran will be going in front of the moon. So it should be going in front of a bunch of other stars, too, because it happens to be right in the Hyades there. So we should be able to see the moon blocking or going in front of quite a few stars. So that'd be an interesting night if you're out observing Sunday night, if you have some clear weather. And, it's kind of close to full moon, but kind of who cares? It is a full moon, actually, so it doesn't really matter. But So when you have Aldebaran, first magnitude, the moon covering in front of it, that'll be an easy one to see. Might be hard to see some of the fainter stars of the Hyades get covered up, but Aldebaran would be a nice one. And finally, one for those of us here in North America, get to see something like that.
Now, let's have a look at this picture that's been put in the chat. That's a nice little picture of the moon. Thank you, Aqua, for you. I must go check the take from the telescope I'm using. I left it with a mission to go to the moon, take some pictures for me.
Right.
So later on, I will go check it.
We also have, it's meteor shower time again. This one happens to be the Taurid meteor shower. Generally from around November the 4th through November the 10th. So see if you can catch some of those. And also you might catch a rare Andromeda meteor too. So keep an eye out for those coming up the next 4 or 5 days or so. Full moon, going to be difficult to see some of the fainter ones, but might be able to see some of the brighter ones. Not really a great shower, 5-ish per hour. So not a great meteor shower, but if you do see some, see if we can trace it back and see if it looks like it's coming from the constellation of Taurus, which is well up in the early part of the evening. But it's always better to wait after midnight for the best views of them. That's when the Earth will be twisted and you'll be actually going into the shower and have the best chance of seeing it.
Always good. I have to admit, I've been out most mornings when it's been clear, and I do get some very nice looks at the top part of Canis Major, and certainly Orion is there bold and brilliant in the mornings, so it's quite nice.
I was talking with Aquafew a little earlier in the chat room about he wants to image Thor's hammer, and I looked that one up, and you see 2359, it happens to be just east of the star Sirius, so that's just starting to rise right now.
Well, I've actually imaged Thor's helmet before.
Okay. That's right, helmet. I keep wanting to say hammer, but it's Thor's helmet.
No, it's not Molinar, it's the helmet.
It's the helmet, yes.
Helmet. Yeah, I used to, it's one of the, back in the days when Glenn, myself, and Selby were all in the same place, we would have fun imaging that, and we would cover each other for missions to do that so we could get images and stack and do fun things like that.
And Cass has been reporting seeing meteors for the last 3 days at 5 o'clock in the morning, so cool.
I'm still dominantly just dragging myself out of bed at 5:30.
There you go.
But that's work for you.
All right, let's see. I've just decided to visit the... A couple places, Heavens Above, haven't been there in a little bit for figuring out when the International Space Station is going to be flying over. Let's see where it happened to be over right now. It is right over, tip of South America. So maybe Optronics can be able to see it right now, maybe not. Hard to say. To get on there and put in your coordinates, and then it'll tell you if you can actually see it passing over.
That's the nice thing about the app. It tells me when it's going to be visible. Now, I actually use a program called PCSat32, and that gives me everything. That tells me when I can see it, when I can hear it, and I do put an ear out, turn on a radio or two to see if I can hear either the beacons from the ISS on 2 meters and 70 centimeters.
I've recently revisited a website called CalSky, CalSky. It's a way of figuring out if satellites will be passing in front of the sun, the moon, or planets or other things like that in your area. And I haven't been here in a while, and I just started getting back into it, and I'm finding it's like, I don't seem to be able to figure it out as much as before. There's a big front section about your location, but then not getting any dates for when things will be passing in front of something. So maybe I've got to go back over again. So
I get emails from it all the time.
I'm not talking about alerts. I'm talking about just going to the site and pulling up a list of satellites that will be passing in front of things. So I think I need to go revisit it in a little bit more and read it a little bit more in detail. So if you're thinking about that, you might want to, again, go back and visit it so you get familiar with how to use the program, the website, and maybe you'll see something pass in front of something interesting. I know our buddy down south, Stephen Ramsden, from the Charlie Bates Solar Astronomy Project, also known as solarastronomy.org. He just imaged the International Space Station in going in front of the sun from his location. That was just about 2 weeks ago, actually. Still a project I want to do.
Now, you can also use it to track Taoyong 1 and Taoyong 2.
Yes.
Because they're also another pair of bright objects in our sky.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say, it's free to register, and... For instance, if I go on to asteroids, so it talks about a little bit about them, and it gives you some interesting information, shows you their distribution on the ecliptic.
You can temporarily register. You don't even have to register. You can just go in and type in your coordinates, and it'll generate some chart for when things are going to happen in your area or within, like, for instance, 15 miles of your area. So if you want to go see something and it's going to be a little bit away from where you're actually at right now, you can generate data for that too. So you can do a little bit of traveling and catch something interesting. I want to see the space station flying in front of the sun and in front of the moon.
I like it because I actually I'm logged into it 99% of the time. It sends me emails. It tells me what's available. Tells me what's bright, what isn't, if I tell it what telescopes I have, it will pretty much tell you everything you need to know. It gives you data charts, perihelia, everything. So, for instance, if I just go into setup right now, he says keeping an eye on the time. We've got 15 minutes or there as well. So, what you can do is you can select your geographical location.
Yep.
And therefore, you give it you give this site a name, like home, observatory, or whatever. You can choose your language. It's either a choice of English or German. And that way, first thing you need to do is define your site. So, for instance, I'm going to put...
Now, is this Kalsky or Heavens Above?
This is Kalsky.
Kalsky, okay.
So I'm got it set for choose a country to the United States.
Okay.
Let's see, Albany, New York.
Okay.
Go. So it's now going to tell me. It asks me what my time zone is.
Yep.
And then it asks you your astronomical experience from a hobby astronomer. I don't have a clue. I'm curious, learner, or an astronomer. Well, I'm an astronomer. So anyway, next time it says it asks for more settings. So it's going to let you pick fonts, calendar entry reminders, so which means you can actually import a Kalsky event into your own calendar application, i.e. Google Calendar or Outlook. Now, sometimes it's going to ask if you want to use Google Maps. So you can link to Google Maps as well.
Okay.
Then it says free login and registry.
There, yes.
And so you pick your username, Sirius the Dog Star, Aquarius, or whatever you want it to be. And then it's going to ask you to set a password, and they'll ask you for your email address. You will not get spammed. Trust me. I've been getting mails from these guys for so long. I had never had anything I didn't want from them.
Now, it says that this is an option, but you don't have to actually do it.
That's correct. That's okay. Correct. So by the good thing about doing it is that when you tell it what you like to do, it will then start sending you reports.
Okay.
So.
How about if I want to find out, okay, now where do I go from that? I did this. Now where do I go to find out what's going to be the next object in my area, for instance?
And let me just log into one of my user profiles. I haven't done this for ages.
Okay. So I want to do this all as a temporary thing. I just want to go in here tonight. Put in my information, and then figure out where things are going to happen, where and when things are going to happen in the sky next. So
you press the button. It says press this button to accept your inputs.
Okay, now is the green button or the word go?
It's a green button.
Oh, the green button doesn't do anything for me.
Oh dear. Okay, so it's got, you must press this button to accept your input. It says green for go. So, okay, I've got it set up for Albany, New York. Okay, and it's got the United States, country name, site name. Yeah, that's fine.
I pushed the word go, and it just went back to the personalize your CalSky page.
That's interesting. It's done that for me, too. Oh, dear.
So where is the actual information? That's what I was wondering.
Choose your language. On that.
So I think
you've got to put a name for your site.
Name for my site?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to put home.
I did put a name for my site. Yes, I did that. And then we'll figure this out here. Everybody can even join us too if you want to. Or just go to CalSky.
Join and have some fun with us. Okay, yeah. So where it says choose country and location, I've clicked go there, and it's told me it's given the city, it's given the location, and the nice thing is it gives me the Maidenhead locator too, because obviously someone's told it I'm a radio amateur.
maybe I've got to type in all these little red buttons are here. So. Let's choose location, larger city near me. Maybe it's a required field that I didn't put in, so I can try that. Let's try this. All right, I did that.
This has been updated this year on the 27th of October.
Okay.
So I'm just going to accept the cookies.
Yep.
So let's go back to them. I'm just going to pop back to the chat room.
Alrighty. So I'm still trying to get some information out of here. So maybe I missed some field or something like that. So my location keeps changing.
I forgot to do it to log in. We have to actually log in. But you know what? Creating a login is very, very simple. And it's probably worth it actually in the long run. So let me just remember, I've got to remember how to log in. I haven't been here for quite a while.
Every time I do a login and a password, I always forget my login and password. So I try to go back again. And then if I remember the login name, but not the password, it tells me that somebody else has my login name. Yes, I have my login name. I can't remember my password. So I don't like to use login names and passwords.
I've never had that problem. I just got to remember how to log into the site. I haven't used it for a long time that way.
Okay. So I'm not typing something in. Maybe that's requiring the information to pop up for me. So, and then where happens after that? Do you remember?
Basically, you can then decide telling it what you want to see.
Okay.
So it's actually telling me right now, Tuesday, the 7th of November, there's a Vega launch. Today at CalSky, 51 meteor streams, 943 comets, 685 astronomy shops, 160 star parties, 26,010 satellites.
But what about transits? Satellite transits, that's what I want.
Yes, you can get satellites too.
But where is that? Where is
it? It's actually under today at CalSky. I'm going to try so I can remember one of my usernames.
Okay. So I can't find out what's going to happen when yet.
Just a second.
Maybe I'm doing something wrong here. I don't. Let's see what else has come up. All right, you do that. You try to figure that out. Let's see. I've got a little article here. ELMA. The Altacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, they actually discovered some dust around Proxima Centauri. Now, that's a star that goes around Alpha Centauri, and Proxima Centauri is the one that has the planet called, what's it called? Proxima Centauri B? Proxima B, yes. So they've actually discovered a dust cloud, a couple of dust clouds, going around the star.
And I have got my login details.
All right. I'll keep going with this one, then you get that ready. So let me put this article into our chat room here. So, yes, they've actually discovered some new dust around Proxima Centauri. which is an indication that there's also potentially other planets in this system besides Proxima B.
Yes, I saw that. I think I posted a link to that today from the ESO.
Okay.
Okay, I'm now in, and I'm actually... Let me just change my location.
Where's this article at? I've got this one from SciTech Daily, but it's out there in a lot of places too. So
yeah, the ESO actually sent out an email. So if you happen to be signed up on a student account, like Muggins is.
With the European Space Agency?
No, the European Southern Observatory.
European Southern Observatory. That is correct, yes.
So, okay. Yeah, so...
So that's kind of cool. There's like more stuff going around the system. So the dust cloud is actually beyond outside of Proxima B. And then there's it's a little bit bigger one. Then there's one even farther out. So, again, they're thinking that it's mostly small stuff too, kind of like our asteroid field, but with a lot more stuff, a lot more dust, dirt, and particles and things like that too. So obviously they'll be keeping, they'll be checking it, and I assume looking for clumps and things like that. And then that also means potentially more planets. So continuing the search for more planets in our closest neighbor star system.
Now, I actually got to my account. So once you're in there, all the things like meteor streams, click on that, and it tells you, it calculates the visibility of meteor shooting stars of the following streams. So at the moment, it's going to give me a printout, and it lists all the streams. So you can calculate the visibility. So let me just go back here 1 second.
All right.
It says, please be patient. It may take up to 60 seconds, depending on the current load. So if you've got about 80 or 90 people, it's going to take a little while. So let me just X out of that request. Okay, satellite elements. Satellites, here we go. Now, it lists all the artificial satellites, starting with Vanguard 1. It goes through the Tyros, Transit, SolRad, Echo series, Courier series, Scout, Explorer, Thor Able, Engine, SR3, literally every satellite that's up there is listed. I think there must be, there's over 26,000 pieces of information for each satellite. Yeah. So you can literally pick a satellite. Okay, this for Aleut 2.
So I wonder why it didn't work for me.
Because I'm logged in.
Ah. So I've done it without logging in before, I think.
Yeah, it's telling me that the Aleut 2 rocket, brightness is between 3.2 at perigee, full illumination, to 5.5 mag at 50% illumination. It has a 5-meter square radar cross section, and its designator, its space com designator is 1965-098C. And it gives you the elements, this 0.5 day element.
So all this pop up after you hit the press this button to accept your inputs?
Yeah.
Did it pop up automatically?
Basically, what it is, in the box, we're running out of time. The welding party's going to get back together. Where's Starstorm? We're going to get ready together for beam out shortly.
We had a couple minutes yet. Okay.
So anyway, it tells you on one side what's visible.
Mm-hmm.
So you select satellites. And then it takes you to another page where it lists all the satellites that are available to you.
Mm.
So this is going through pretty much everything that was launched up from the 50s onwards.
Okay. I have to go back over it and figure out how I can get in temporarily, and I'll let everybody know how to do that too. So
it is worth having as a permanent login. I've got about 8 different locations set up, from Keswick in the Lake District to my hometown in the UK to here in the US and several other places. Particularly the places I use for remote imaging. So they're all on there, and I can see what's what. Yep, I'm gonna. I think we're getting a signal. Just one second.
We're getting pretty close. Yeah, about time for us to.
This is the away team to Captain Savick on the USS Miranda. Three ready for beam out, and please, Captain, make it fast.
Oh, we got time.
We got time.
Did I hear the chirp?
Yep, I heard the chirp.
Oh, I didn't hear the chirp. There you go. All right. Well, thanks, okay, everybody, for tuning in tonight. Really appreciate you being here. Appreciate everybody in our chat room tonight. Don't forget, we've got more programming coming up, like 365. And thanks, everybody, in our chat room. And we'll be back again next week.
See you on
next
week.
All right, everyone.
My throat will be a lot better, too.
Yeah. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
See you next time.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are Astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the Voice of Astronomy. Around the world and across the known universe, this is Astronomy.fm Radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
There I was, doing my thing. And all of a sudden, wham! Astronomy right between the eyes.